School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's show, we're going to take a look at two different countries where it's incredibly difficult to be an independent reporter. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from a young Cuban journalist who is at the forefront of efforts to spread independent news in the communist nation. But first, we're going to turn our attention to Pakistan. This is a country where journalists routinely face threats, not only from the Taliban and other Islamic radical groups, but also from the government and its intelligence agencies. One region of the country that is particularly difficult for the press is the tribal regions of northern Pakistan near the border with Afghanistan. This is an area where stories about suicide bombings or thwarted attacks come nearly every week. We're joined today by a prominent journalist from this part of Pakistan. Salman Yousafzai is a reporter from the Frontier Post in Peshawar, Pakistan, where he's covered crime and terrorism. He's also done investigative work for Dawn.com, the website of Pakistan's most widely read English-language newspaper. Salman is visiting the U.S. on a fellowship from the Alfred Friendly Press Partners program with funding from the Daniel Pearl Foundation. Salman, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
Well, tell us, if you would, about the issue of terrorism in Peshawar, in the region where you are. Many of our viewers may remember that there was an absolutely horrific attack on a school there back in 2014. Something like 141 people were killed, almost all of them school children, by Islamic extremists, a group linked to the Taliban. What has the government done to sort of enhance security in your region? Why is there still a problem?
I will tell you that 142 children were killed in that incident, and like it was very horrific incident like I have ever seen and I have ever reported in my life. Like at that day, it was actually military-run school, military-run public school. So at that day, we are not allowed to go inside and see what's going on at the time when the Taliban attacked at that school. But I have personally seen a lot of scene especially in hospital when mothers and their father were crying and they come to hospital to search out their dead bodies of their children. So it is hard for journalists to see such kind of things. And as far as like our government is trying to like get rid from this kind of terrorism from terrorist groups. And like after that incident, our military has also started a national action plan and they said that they will like start operation against militants without any discrimination, without good Taliban and bad Taliban. Like earlier, it was also a concept.
So earlier, the Pakistani military was working with some elements of the Taliban and other elements.
It was a good Taliban, but after that, they start to launch operation against such kind of elements without any discrimination. So, but it is still not going like...
Well, tell me if you would, what are some of the challenges for Pakistani reporters in covering the Taliban and Islamic extremists?
Pakistan is the fourth most dangerous country for the journalists. Like, I think more than 60 journalists have been killed in the line of duty when they were covering different kind of incidents. Especially in Peshawar, there are also like many journalists have been killed due to their profession. So it is hard for journalists.
So is it common to be threatened then?
Yep, sometimes.
And you yourself, have you been threatened?
Yep, sometimes.
And how do you get these threats?
People receive threats from like unknown numbers, and nowadays like it's a new trend has been started in Pakistan that they will receive call from unknown number, and sometime they will receive call from Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. So you get a call from Afghanistan, like, and someone on the line will be threatening you.
Yeah. Like Afghanistan is also like located close to us. We are living in the border it's our neighboring country. So sometimes they will receive. So you cannot do anything. Like if you receive a threat, so you cannot trace them, that who they were.
What are the topics that are particularly sensitive?
Yeah, if sometime if you are like writing about militant groups, there are a lot of different kind of militant groups operating in Pakistan. More than 42, I think. They are only operating in our region, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and FATA and federally administered tribal area. So sometime if you are writing against them, and also it's happening if you are writing against agencies, different kind of military agencies and
military agencies and intelligence agencies.
Intelligence agency, yeah. So sometime you will ask, mostly they call from unknown numbers.
Well, you have also done a number of investigative pieces that I enjoyed reading. There was one in particular about the status of transgender people in Pakistan. And you said in your piece, I believe this was on the website New Lens, you talked about your region, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. There were 45 transgender people who have been killed since 2015. And you told the story about one transgender woman who was taken to a hospital. She had been shot 6 times and she was brought to the hospital still alive. And the doctors there couldn't decide whether or not to send her to the men's ward or to the woman's ward. And while they were debating this issue, she died on the emergency room table, it sounds like. Tell us about this issue. What's happening?
Yeah, it was also a big problem in Pakistan, especially in our region. And the transgender community were not treating well in our, especially in different parts of Pakistan, but especially in Pakistan, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. But right now Peshawar is basically a provincial capital of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. So this was also a bad incident which took place in Peshawar, and the transgender community bring
who's
them.
Who's killing them? Is it?
Yeah, it was actually his own boyfriend, said to be a boyfriend, he shot him, and
that's one specific case. But in general, who is attacking transgender people?
When they go for some kind of programs, they usually go on weddings and other kind of parties. So when they go there, so usually people harass them, and sometimes they threatened them, and sometimes they even killed them.
It does seem that the situation for transgender people in this part of Pakistan, where there are some very conservative religious people, it's actually quite nuanced. You reported a story about an prominent Islamic council of muftis actually endorsing marriage between transgender persons. So what does that tell us?
Actually, after filing that story, this story was many people reported about that incident when that specific transgender was brought to hospital and he was not treated well. They were sent to male ward. There are different kind of ward in the hospital. So when they were sent it to male ward and they were not accepting that, we are not accepting him, he is not a male, when they brought them to female ward, so they were also
so these stories of stories are actually
story,
common.
It was a bit that story was common. So afterward, the muftis, they says that they can marry it, and they allow to marry them, and they also issue a kind of fatwa, which is fatwa,
a religious decree.
Yeah, a religious decree. So they issued that, and after that they were start marrying. But I did the story in detail, so I also talked to these transgender. They told me that we are not like each other.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you've also done some healthcare reporting that I thought was quite interesting. I understand that in Pakistan there are 25,000 infants that die each year from tetanus or lockjaw, and of course this is easily preventable with vaccines. So why is it the case that so many babies were dying of this easily preventable disease? What was the government response to your reporting on this issue?
Actually, government did not pay too much attention to such kind of stories. But anyhow, like after filing this story, the government like gave them some funds to buy such vaccines. It's a TIJ vaccine to anti-tetanus vaccines. So after filing their story, government had did something and like, but our government, especially in health sector, they are not doing well.
Well, you've also reported on a problem in Pakistan that is also a big issue here in the U.S. Midwest, and that is methamphetamine or meth addiction. Tell us about that.
Yeah, meth addiction nowadays, like it is introduced in new, it is right now, like around in 2012, it was introduced in our region. It was not earlier in our region, about like people usually use hashish and different kind of other drugs, but it was newly introduced, and mostly people like here in USA, they are like taking this drug in parties and other things, but in our region, like it was a bit conservative, so people are not going for parties and other, but they are using it like on daily basis, just sitting in one room and like they are taking this drug. So it was affecting their health and other things. So I wish to write, even one of my friend, he was using this drug. So after when I see him that he's using this drug, and I like talk to doctors that what's the side effects of this drug. So they told me, so I like the idea came in my mind and I filed this story.
Well, talk to us generally about the current government's attitude towards journalists. When you report on these issues that seem to be of enormous public interest, public consequence, is this well received?
Government, if you write story against government, it is not a big problem. But if you write a story against like military and other agencies, or you are writing story about sensitive issues like religion and these kind of things, so then you will face threats, and you will like face many kind of problems.
Salman Yousafzai, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Global Journalist. Up next, we're going to talk to a young reporter working in a country labeled the worst of the worst for press freedom by the group Freedom House. But before we get there, I want to remind you that if you want more Global Journalist, you can visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you'll find our ongoing coverage of undercovered international news and human rights issues. You can also check out Global Journalist on Facebook or Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. Joining me now is a reporter from Cuba. Independent media based in this country was virtually non-existent for decades, but technological changes has made stopping independent reporting more difficult for Raúl Castro's government. Joining us to talk about the challenges of trying to do independent reporting in Cuba is Teo Escobar. Teo works for the country's first independent digital news outlet, 14 Medio. He's covered stories about a dissident rapper and Cuban perceptions of U.S. politics. Teo is the 21-year-old son of Yoni Sanchez, the founder of 14 Medio and one of Cuba's best-known independent journalists. Teo is visiting the Missouri School of Journalism through a fellowship from the Alfred Friendly program. Teo, welcome.
Oh, thanks a lot.
First of all, tell us if you would just a little bit about your mother. Why is it that she is so well known in Cuba?
Well, my mother started in 2007 with a blog called Generación Y, Generation Y, which basically collected all the issues of a whole generation, the generation of those people that were born under the Soviet-subsided Cuba.
Right. This is a time when the Soviet Union was giving a lot of subsidies to keep the Cuban government in business, right?
Yeah, and covering all the disappointments such a generation faced, on one hand, when the Soviet subside ended, and they had to face a new Cuba after the Soviet Union disappeared.
Right. In the early 1990s, there was a big economic collapse. And so why is it then that this blog resonated so much with people?
Well, it resonated so much good because it was a generation whose voice was silenced for a long time. It didn't appear on the official media, because their story was very non-favorable to the government's propaganda, and it revealed awful truth that they've been trying, the government media have been trying to cover, to give, so to give a good impression to their allies in
but
the exterior.
But this sort of dissent and these sorts of feelings, I imagine your mother is not the only one in Cuba who felt this way, and typically the Cuban government's response has been to put people dissenting, expressing these sorts of views, in jail. What's happened with your mother?
Well, the difference is that in 2007, even though Cuba has been for a long time a country very without technological advancement, technology got to Cuba, especially the internet started to open just a bit. And through that small crack in the wall, she managed to put a blog online and express opinions. The government didn't have control on the online content. They couldn't just delete that. If back in the days a journalist will publish an unfavorable story against the government in newspaper, they would just take out those newspapers, and no one will remember any of that. But technology made a difference.
Okay, and so give us just a little bit, if you would, about 14 Medio then, because it sounds like your mother's project. It evolved from what was originally a blog to what's now a news gathering organization that is trying to have independent journalists on the ground in Cuba reporting Cuban news.
Well, 14 Medio started in 2014 as an idea, as a project to make serious, professional, independent journalism in Cuba. In a way such that we, well, on one hand, some of the independent news outlet that started in Cuba since 2008 till 2013 or so, were mainly focused on the political aspect, as it was precisely the one that got you in most trouble. But 14 Medio tried to be a more broad newspaper that didn't only, whose sole purpose was not to criticize the government policies, but as to be the newspapers of the newspaper of tomorrow's Cuba, the Cuba of the future, where doing journalism will no longer be a stigma, will doing journalism will no longer divide you between someone who makes propaganda that favors the government or someone who only criticizes what's wrong with the country.
Okay, so it sounds like what she is doing is trying to create something that is much broader. But let me ask you about your own background in journalism. I understand that you did not go to journalism school in Cuba. Tell us about that.
I didn't go to journalism school. I am currently attending the university. I'm studying philosophy at the Havana University. But on one hand, back then, when I just entered college, I didn't have in mind studying journalism. But on the other hand, the journalism school in Cuba has very strict ideological filters. So if you wanted to enter the journalism school, you will have to prove your political loyalty to the Communist Party and to the government.
How do you do that?
Well, they have tests, different tests that they measure how informed you are in the state-owned media and how well you can do apologetics of the government's version of Cuba's reality.
Well, let me ask you about your work for 14 Medio, for other news outlets. What are some stories that you have done that have been sensitive or that may have gotten you in trouble?
Well, so far, I haven't gotten in as much trouble as many journalists that are doing serious independent journalism in Cuba. Although that's probably because our media is in the center of the spotlight, and that sort of gives you some protection, as being so notorious makes it harder for you to be jailed or beaten without it make it being public.
So in other words, because your mother is such a prominent figure, her news organization is such a high-profile news organization within Cuba, In a way, this provides you some protection.
Yes. Back in the days, it will have the opposite effect. Being so notorious will mean you will be the nail that sticks out, and you will get hammered the hardest. But now it's a bit different since there are many new news outlets. But getting back to your question of stories I made, there was this story about back in October, well, actually in September, before the U.S. elections, we went to the streets and asked people about what they thought about the U.S. elections, and most people were very in Cuba. Most people were very afraid of telling what their thoughts about it.
Even about U.S. politics.
Even about U.S. politics.
Why is that?
Well, we've been thought since the early grades in school that politics are a no-no conversational subject, that you simply do not talk about politics. That's something you leave to politics. Okay. Politics are the only ones who are politicians, I mean, are the only ones that are allowed to talk about politics. And people were just very afraid. The ones who knew very little, and basically they knew the state-owned media's version, which was very, very biased.
Okay. And, well, tell us, if you would, just a little bit about, speaking of this bias here, tell us, if you would, about how Cubans perceive the media that they get. Because on the one hand, it seems like many Cubans, overwhelmingly on the airwaves, in print, they're getting government propaganda from within Cuba. But there's also media from the United States, from Miami, where there's a large Cuban exile community that has its own news outlets focused on getting news to Cubans inside Cuba. How do they perceive those two different sides of the story, if you will?
Well, on one hand, especially the Miami medias that focus on Cuba subjects are sort of popular we Cubans have for a long time now had this fatal attraction with the United States and its culture. And most Cubans see the Cubans who went to Miami, who are living now in Miami, they look up to those people as they kind of made many Cubans' dreams true. That's what many Cubans dream of just going to Miami and start a Cuban American dream. On one hand, they are quite popular, but they are also blocked, most of them. Either the ones that are the ones are radio wise, they are true radio, or
like Radio Marti, the U.S. funded radio service to Cuba.
Yeah, like Radio Marti, which is illegal, although many people still do it. There are many things that are illegal in Cuba, and we still do them. But on the other hand, most Cubans have a notorious apathy towards news of political content, as we've been raised that way. And most of the time people spend on the very limited internet we have, they spend it not looking for news or news content, but just chatting on Facebook with old friends, or chatting on Skype or Imo, which is another Skype-like app, chatting with their families in the US or anywhere in the world.
So they're using it basically for personal communication. But you mentioned Facebook. I understand Facebook is sort of an interesting case in Cuba because many websites, correct me if I'm wrong, are blocked inside Cuba. However, you can access a lot of different information just through Facebook.
Yeah, well, nowadays there are not that many websites blocked. Back 6 years ago, there were a couple of the most notorious websites of news papers were blocked. But now they 14 Medio is still blocked, 14medio.com. Although you can enter it using VPNs, you know, anonymous proxies. But Facebook is not blocked at all. So anyone who enters Facebook can view 14 Medio's Facebook page. So that's a very important way for us to communicate with our audience in Cuba.
So it sounds like when you hear people talk about like the Great Firewall in China that walls off that country's internet, it sounds like there's something similar in Cuba, although perhaps the firewall is smaller and has more holes in it.
A not so great firewall.
Well, talk to me, if you would, about how Cubans get their information, given how limited the internet penetration is in the country. At one time, there was some attention paid to information, news, entertainment being transmitted on USB, on thumb drives, from person to person in Cuba. Is that still the main way that people are getting news, entertainment from outside the island?
Yeah, well, basically we have this thing called el paquete, which means the pack or the package, which basically means that there are certain people in Cuba that have a really astounding bandwidth, internet connection. So they manage to download basically all sort of multimedia content out each week, like videos, movies, YouTube channels, YouTube channels, videos, and they distribute it to hard drives or pen drives. You just go to one of those stores where they sell el paquete, the pack, and for kind of $2, for almost $2, you can get 1 terabyte of info of everything that went out online this week.
And this is something that you can just buy at a store?
Yeah, stores are obviously not official, but they're borderline legal.
Let me ask you about how the spread of smartphones in Cuba has changed sort of the way people get their information. Obviously, all around the world, it's given people a powerful tool to document injustice, to document problems with their government. How has that shaped Cubans' views about the news and their media?
Well, it's been it has made quite a difference since there's some difficulties yet still with phones, as for example, our phone rates are still very expensive. The phone company, which is a state monopoly, is very harsh on its rates. But now with smartphones, people have the potential to record, take a picture of anything that's going out there. You can become a reporter just by having a smartphone, and it's made the government self-aware of the fragile situation they're in, as they can no longer repress people without and get away with it, as it will at least become public when they do such things.
Well, our time does grow short here, but before you go, I did want to ask you, since you are 21, how do people your age in Cuba, how do they feel about the United States? How do they feel about their government? I imagine their perceptions must be quite different from people who lived through the Cold War period.
Well, most people of my generation have a big dream. That big dream is coming to the U.S. and start a new life here. Some people not coming to the U.S., but starting a new life out of Cuba. And just they feel totally, they don't care at all about politics. They just care about, well, that.
So they care about improving their economic chances.
Improving their economics. And most people don't care about living away, leaving their country, leaving all their culture.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Thanks very much to Teo Escobar.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And our thanks again to Salman Yousafzai as well for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Tomas Orihuela and Lauren Workman, and our supervising producer is Rachel Foster Gimbel. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.